from the tall and lanky studios of Univest at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA, it's time for another nicely pinched episode of Chemical-Free Horticultural Hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. New England asters are great native plants, and their late-in-the-season blooms provide much-needed food for native bees and butterflies, but they often grow way too tall. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll reveal how to keep those fall bloomers looking their tight and tidy best. Plus, your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and seriously serene salutations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up faster than you not needing to crane your neck to see that spectacular late season sight right after this.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, New England asters are a fabulous native plant, and their blooms late in the season are very important at feeding native bees and butterflies. But they can get tall and lanky over time. We'll tell you how to prevent that when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, lots of your fabulous phone calls at 888-492-9444. Darlene, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Darlene. Where are you?
I'm in London, Ontario, Canada, which is about 3 hours east of Lansing, Michigan.
Yes, I've been there, actually.
No way!
Yeah, I attended a couple of medical conferences there back before I started up with gardening. Now,
cool.
You sent us an email on a very important topic. So I'm going to condense this. You have a community garden in a local park, but they're planning major construction this year, like replacing water mains, sanitary sewer service, and tree removal. And you're concerned about the effects on your community garden. And should you actually utilize it this year or let it rest somehow? Am I correct?
Right. Yeah, I'm concerned about potential pollutants like machines belching all kinds of gases throughout the season. I'm also concerned about dust and whether or not plants can actually photosynthesize under that.
Well, you don't. If they are covered by dust, you don't do it. Now,
right.
You sent us, it's a relatively small garden, right? It's like 12 by 12. And
yeah, it's actually 12 by 13, which is really odd, but yeah.
Yeah, well. Stuff happens, and it's divided into six plots. Am I correct from your imaging?
Yeah, that was just my plot. But the garden itself, like the entire community garden, it has an orchard in it. It's about 50 feet by 300 feet.
And where is the construction going to take place? Is the garden going to be surrounded by this stuff?
Yes, it is. It's going to be on the north side of our garden, and it's going to happen about 25 to 50 feet, depending on where your plot is.
Away?
Right.
Oh, and it's on the north side. So your south side and your east side are open, so to speak?
Well, I guess it will go through the west side as well and along the south side. So our east side doesn't have that major construction.
But they're not going to undermine the garden. They're not going to dig through the garden.
They have closed half of the garden this year, but my plot remains.
Oh, so this is this isn't about you. It's about me, huh? My gut instincts are to eat this year. Now, is there, you know, putting it really simply, your fellow gardeners, many of them are going to have to start over next year, right?
Right.
Repairing their plots. I can see a lot of potential trouble. I'm concerned about the dust. But you make a good point. You know, if they're using old school gasoline engines, they can really stink up the place. And it sounds like it's not going to be a very pleasant place to be. So
right. And that's why I love that garden. I love like just chatting with people and seeing what they're growing. It's a really fun place to be, but I feel like people are just going to bug out this year.
Have you spoken to your fellow gardeners?
I have, and they seem to be on the fence as well about what they're planning on doing.
Well, you have to be on the fence in a situation like this because we can't really predict the enormity of what's going to happen. Now, you mentioned fruit trees. Are they going to be affected?
Well, I hope not. There's this beautiful orchard in our garden. We grow fruit trees and berries, all kinds of perennials that have been established there for quite some time. So I hope they won't be affected.
And have you been in discussions about, this is a community park?
Yes.
Have you been in discussions with the people who run the park?
I unfortunately missed the city meeting that was held. Well, but the leaders of the garden have gone to it, and they have told me that they're up in the air about it as well.
Okay, so they don't know if they're going to damage the fruit trees or the berries.
Right.
Well, you're in a load of woe, lady. I was going to suggest that if, for instance, all the construction was going to be on one side of the garden, like the north side, there are barriers that can be temporarily constructed that would prevent the dust and everything, most of it, from getting in there. And you had me excited because you said the part that faces south and or east is not going to be affected. But now I'm seeing more of this being a New Yorker kind of island with two guys and a palm tree surrounded by construction. Is there an interim spot in which you and your fellow gardeners could cultivate?
An interim, what was that?
Spot, a location, an open field somewhere that's not affected by this.
Well, there is a baseball diamond, but...
You can't take away a baseball diamond?
I know how much you love baseball.
Important as gardening, and they follow the same season.
Want
these kids to be using tomato plants for bases? What is wrong with you?
That's hilarious. No, we don't have another spot to go right now. So I was thinking perhaps we could turn it into a flower field instead of growing food and possibly putting ourselves at risk.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't grow food there. It just, I know this hurts, but physical reality trumps emotion.
Right.
Do you have any land? Do the people in your garden have land? Because I know London is a big city.
Yeah, every house comes with pretty much an amazing backyard. So there is definitely like neighbors and they would let us grow there.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, I think that's the answer. I mean, otherwise you're going to be anxious every day and you're going to be worried about it. You know, rather than flowers, any part of the community garden that is not going to be ripped up should probably be covered with a tarp.
Okay.
And you're in Ontario, you're in Canada, you really don't have a long enough, hot enough summer to solarize the soil. But if you use clear plastic and you get a long, hot, sunny summer, that could actually destroy weed seeds and pathogens in the soil. It can't hurt. But I think the answer here is to cover the soil, protect it. Because if you just grow flowers there, the soil is still going to be contaminated. So
okay.
I think protection of the soil. And if each individual member wants to do that on their own, so to speak, then really what you have to do is stay in touch with the construction people and, you know, maybe post little signs. This is plot number one. This is plot number two. And if they're going to move into those areas, they can contact you. And even more importantly, when they're not near you anymore, they can contact you. And maybe you can get in a late crop of lettuce after you sweep off the tarp, vacuum it, everything like that. But you got, I think the important thing here is forget about it as a garden this summer, but protect the soil from contamination.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Me too, but that's okay. Maybe we'll start a garden somewhere else, Mike.
Well, I think you've explained that you can have gardens in your backyards.
Absolutely.
And I understand the conversational aspect, the community aspect of having...
It's so cool, like, seeing people just grow, like, a forest of tomatoes or, like, all kinds of cool hot peppers. And
so you're going to...
try all these cool things.
You're going to organize at least a monthly tour where you all go and visit each other's gardens, spend the day having tea or a glass of wine, talk about what's happening, and make plans for
fabulous.
Next year. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have
to
lose that. And if people live, like, very close to you, like on the same block or next door, tell them you're going to be in their backyard all the time. So get used to it. Come out and talk.
I love it. Okay, perfect.
All right. Well, good luck to you. You're going to need it.
Thank you.
and at least you're being proactive. I would hate to see you just hope for the best and then have to abandon that garden because it has been covered in God knows what kind of dust and maybe even gasoline spills.
Right.
All right.
Well, I appreciate you taking my call. I hope you have a great day.
Oh, well, thank you. It's an intriguing question. I wish I had a better answer, but I do want to lead you down the right path. Even though it's disappointing, you'll be happy with the results, I think.
Thanks so much, Mike. Take care for now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that I will return to the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, May 7th at 6:30 to present a free lecture session, whatever, in which we will discuss whatever is on your collective gardening minds. But don't go thinking up those questions just yet, because we'll be right back with well-behaved asters and more of your badly behaved phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, New England asters are the perfect native plant to provide blooms late in the season when there isn't a lot else happening. They'll also feed those monarchs who are getting ready to make the last leg of their journey back to where they belong. But a lot of times they get tall and lanky. But you can prevent that, and you would begin to prevent it now. We're going to explain how after more of your fabulous phone calls at 888-492-9444, 888-492-9444, Eric.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Eric. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a problem I wanted to ask you about. It's a small lime tree that is not doing so well in my basement right now.
Oh, okay. Well,
some,
If I were a small lime tree, I probably wouldn't be doing good in your basement either. All right. So, you know, people send us pictures, and, you know, it can be difficult to refer to pictures on a radio show. But this appears to be not a true lime tree, but one of these novelty trees that produces lemons and limes. Didn't you read the side of the pot?
It says citrus cocktail. Oh, yeah, it does say lemon and limes. You're right.
Yeah, and it actually says cocktail tree. You'd make a great witness in a murder investigation. Okay, so tell me how you acquired this specimen.
Well, my wife saw it at the garden shop, and she brought it home, and we had it out on the deck, and it actually produced fruit, and we ate it, and it was good. And then, you know, it started slowly dying. I brought it into the basement, and the dying continued. And I really don't want it to die because that'll probably be a problem for me. So,
well, didn't you realize it would have to come in as soon as the night started to dip in temperature?
Well, yeah, I did bring it in last fall. And, you know, like I said, it produced fruit during the summer, and then it actually started to produce fruit in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
But then it started dying, and the fruit shriveled up and fell off.
Yeah. Why did you condemn it to the basement? Don't you have windows that face south or southeast?
Well, it is by a south window because I got to walk down basement. There's a French door there, but I have grow lights over it that you can't see in the picture.
Right, which means they're probably not doing any good. Regular grow lights really have to be a couple inches from the plants for the plants to absorb the light. What's the temperature down there?
About somewhere between 65 and 70.
Are you lying?
No, I'm not lying.
Okay.
No.
What kind of grow lights?
They say 600. Well, I can't.
No, are they LEDs?
No, they're full spectrum lights, and they're 24 watts, and they're about I'd say 5 feet above the plant.
Okay, so they're fluorescent.
I hope not.
We only got three choices here: incandescent, fluorescent, and LEDs. I mean, what else is there?
Well, I thought they were LEDs.
Oh, okay.
They could be.
You are the worst witness we've ever had on the stand.
Well, I'm sorry about
that. All right. So, and how far away are the lights from the plant?
About 4 feet.
Okay. And have you fed this thing or anything?
Yeah, I feed it. I got a little Miracle Grow fertilizer that I put in once a month, about a teaspoon.
Oh, my God. Why?
Well, I thought it was the right thing to do.
Oh, I thought it was the right thing to do. Break out the T-shirt. Limes and lemons. Again, you have a novelty tree where two different fruits have been grafted onto a rootstock. Now, these trees are always going to be more sensitive than a straight lemon or lime. But they are designed to go outside in the summer and inside in the fall and winter, of course, and not to be put out too early in the spring. So they do need to be fed because they are continuous growers. They don't go dormant like other houseplants. But Miracle-Gro, especially in the smallish container you have it on, that's just going to build up toxic mineral salts. There is no miracle growing nature. It's just the miracle of soil. So what you want to do is, first of all, clean off all the dead leaves on top of the soil. It looks awful. And then one side of the tree, maybe one third of the tree, is dead. So prune that off, all the totally brown stuff that's curling up and not enhancing the look of the plant. So get rid of that, and then you'll have green growth left behind. Any discolored leaves or leaves that are curling up, remove those immediately. Is it near a heat source or a vent of any kind?
No, it's not. I had a problem with that last year, so I learned from experience.
Okay. All right. Well, yes. cut off what's bad. Get all the dead leaves off the surface of the soil. Now, I see that the cocktail tree, the pot, the original pot, is sitting in a dish.
Yes.
And I seem to see water in the bottom of the dish.
You're right. There is water in there.
Okay. Well, you've tried to kill this thing 16 times sideways. No plant wants to sit in water. So what you do is take the plant, which is a small size, take it to a sink, put a couple inches of water in the sink, and leave it sit in the sink for like an hour or so, and it'll draw the water up through the drainage holes, and that will saturate the soil. You've got it inside a big plastic tray and that plate, so you can use... Well, what you're supposed to do is you take it out of the sink. You put it on a drain board or something like that. Let it drain. And then if you want to use a plate or a dish or something like that to protect the surface underneath, that's fine. But no water in it. There should never be water in it. Plants have to dry out in between watering. And because it is over winter, you're going to water it very infrequently. And get your, I don't know if you make compost, if you have compost, but knock off the Miracle-Gro and give it an inch of compost on top of the soil. That's all the feeding the plant needs. And then, you know, and drop the lights down to maybe at most 2 feet, but I'd rather see them about a foot above the plant. And then, you know, if you're telling the truth about the temperature and everything, you should be okay. Wait till nights are in the 50s to take it back outside. And bring it in before nights drop into the high 40s. You don't want to mess around with, oh, it's going to freeze tomorrow, because by then the plant will already be hurting. So you do that, and you got a good shot, man.
I'm going to take the shot. Thank you very much for your help.
All right. Good luck, sir.
All right. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 888-492-9444. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky, Tom. Thank you for asking. How are you, sir?
I'm very well also.
And where is Tom very well also?
I live in Denver, Colorado.
Okay, mile high. What can we do you for?
Well, I have a question about how to approach spring watering. Colorado is pretty dry, and usually we get the most of our precipitation in the form of snowstorms in March.
Mm-hmm.
And that usually holds enough moisture in the ground to get through, March, April and May.
Mm-hmm.
But if I put something like, specifically, I put sweet peas into the ground, you know, I'll take a moisture meter and I'll stick it next to it, and I can feel in the soil. The soil's wet, but it's also very windy here. And I'm just not sure what the best way to keep the plants happy.
Gotcha. I've been to Colorado, and when I was there, I stayed with gardeners, and you are an intrepid bunch. You guys can get snow in July. I mean, it can be crazy there. Now, you say, quote, sweet peas. Do you mean the flower or do you mean the edible pea?
Yeah, I mean the flower.
Oh, okay. Because you realize they're poisonous and they can't be eaten like regular peas.
I hope not.
Well, I'm not sure what that means, Tom. Does that mean you ate it?
I think Yes. No, it means I'm glad they're not poisonous.
Yeah.
I'm not planning to eat them.
They
are poisonous. I'm glad I'm not planning to eat them.
There you go. But you're going to smell them, right? They have an alluring fragrance.
I hope so.
First time?
This is my second year. And last year when I planted them, they came up, but I started maybe in May instead of this year. I started in late February.
Really? Outside? So outdoors?
I put a couple of chitted ones outdoors, and they did come up, but mostly my back porch is a great cold frame, so I just started them indoors.
Yeah, I mean, timing where you are, you don't need me to tell you, it's incredibly tricky, but I wouldn't move stuff outdoors very quickly. Now, you have two things going on. Now, again, because of what you just said, your sweet peas, are they in mm-hmm. the ground or are they in containers on a porch?
The right now, they're in the ground.
Oh, okay. When did you transplant them?
When?
Yes.
Let me...
Just vaguely.
I think it's about 2 weeks now.
Okay. So, and it hasn't been freezing cold?
No.
Okay, good.
No, and I have... Yeah, no, we've had no freeze.
Okay. Your enemy is the wind. If you mm-hmm. think of the plant, use your X-ray vision, you've got roots going down into moist soil. But the top of the plant is being desiccated by your legendary winds. So even though the heart of the plant, the root of the plant, has access to water, the wind is sucking the water out of the plant. So,
okay. You
know, I think Oregon may have been the place where windbreaks were discovered, because this is a very common problem in windy areas like Chicago and Oklahoma and where you are. And even though it doesn't seem like it's any rational part of gardening, protecting plants from the wind can make the difference between success and failure. Again, you seem to have determined that your soil moisture is adequate to more than adequate, but it sounds like, you know, and it almost might look like the tops of the plants are burning up a little or something like that, but by having...
I haven't noticed like any kind of bleaching. They just look stunted.
So they're not growing fast enough for you?
They are not.
Okay. So
they seem like they're growing fine. For 2 weeks, I would think it would take like, what, 3 or 4 weeks for it to kind of get rooted in and then ready to go.
Right. Everything depends on, you know, the temperature, the timing, fate. Maybe I'm a little confused. So what is your concern here? You just want to know how often to water them?
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean,
typically,
I do want that like for spring. I guess I understand how to water in the summer. No problem.
Okay.
But watering in the spring is tricky for the aforementioned reasons.
Well, you've got plenty of water at the root zone, so we don't want to saturate that. More plants die from overwatering than underwatering.
Yes.
What I would do is make sure you have a nice natural mulch on the surface of the soil, so as you get into your really dry time, you're conserving that good snowmelt moisture that you have in the soil. And then, you know, when you no longer can find any moisture down at the root zone, you want to water deeply once a week.
Sure.
And that's,
that makes sense.
You know, a lot of people make the mistake of going out and watering for 10 minutes a day and thinking they're doing a good job, and the plants never get watered. In Colorado especially, I saw a lot of drip irrigation. How do you water your plants or your garden?
I use, in this bed, I use a drip hose, a drip tape. But I'm part of an HOA, so putting in a full drip system is a challenge.
Oh, well, no, that's okay. A drip tape is fine. It's going to, you know, drip moisture into the soil slowly, and you cover it with mulch and nobody sees it. And more importantly, yep. In the summertime, the mulch prevents evaporation. Everything you put on goes down into the root system. So your Great. Only task is to figure out how long it takes that tape to drip the equivalent of an inch of water. And maybe maybe you can cheat by putting a can underneath one of them, excavating some soil, and seeing how long it takes. It should take several hours, if not even longer. And you do that once a week if we don't get rain, which, you know, you won't get rain over the summer. And if the right, exactly. If the temperatures exceed like 95 degrees, you can do that twice a week. Again, the more often, the windier it is, the more often, because especially once that water is out of the root zone, it is going to dry out your plants, the wind.
Okay. Yes.
Definitely. All right.
All right. I really appreciate your help.
Oh, my pleasure. You take care, and I hope you get your sweet peas.
Me too. Bye-bye, Neil.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that I will return to the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, May 7th at 6:30 for a free event in which I will discuss whatever is on your gardening mind. That's if you're in the audience, of course. But don't go thinking up your question just yet, because we'll be right back with what you need to do now to prepare for the best-looking asters in the fall. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
This is 91.3 FM, WLVR Bethlehem, WLVR.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will tell you the secret of how to keep your fall blooming asters looking nice and compact. Matter of fact, it's the same secret you can use to get your hardy mums to bloom the way they did when you bought them last year instead of the ungodly mess they become on their own. So you won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up after another phone call at 888-492-9444. Frank, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Michael. Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you, Frank. I hope you're doing well. Now, I'm going to take a sideways route here and tell our audience that you sent in an email with four different questions on it, which is murder for me. But I told my producer I was going to pick one just for the timing of the year, if nothing else. But the other three, you want to discuss the benefits of raising mason bees. Number two, forget about it, books on apple diseases. If you want to learn about apple diseases in your location, which, by the way, is a place called Warriors Mark, PA. And when I finally found it on the map, it's near Penn State. Am I correct?
That is correct, yes. That's my employer also.
Okay. How small is Warriors Mark?
It's a little town, probably 200 people approximately, and near Tyrone, Pennsylvania.
In cases like that, we often ask, is there a stoplight?
Actually, there is one, yes.
Okay. All right. So you asked if I could recommend books that showed apple diseases. I'm always reluctant to do that because the books come and go so rapidly. but you can get up to the minute information from your local extension service, which luckily happens to be where you work over at Penn State. That is the Soil Lab for Pennsylvania. It's also where they put out all the instructional bulletins and, you know, helpers for Pennsylvania farmers and gardeners. And they will provide you with not only dirty pictures of apple diseases, but they'll concentrate on the ones in our area, not just Pennsylvania, but you can isolate it down to your unique climate near Penn State. Okay, that's a freebie.
That would work out very well.
That's a freebie.
Excellent. Thank you.
And the last one is you want a weed killer. Now, you know, that's complicated because it always depends on where the weed is. So I'm going to choose. What a shock. And let's talk about mason bees. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been reading about mason bees and their benefits, and recognizing that you shouldn't necessarily believe everything you read. But it sounds to me as if there's some great benefits associated with doing so. And I never heard of the practice up until a year ago.
And you're talking about commercial.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are firms out there that sell mason bees for you to populate, if you will, in mason housing, little housing,
mm-hmm.
that come out and during the early part of summer, late spring, and do supposedly a tremendous job of pollination.
They are excellent pollinators, and it is very easy to attract your own native bees. I'm always skittish about buying insects online because you don't want to be bringing in a mason bee from another part of the country to possibly displace your native population. So I'll tell you, I mean, this is a great thing to do for school children. Now, the classic way to do this, and you're going to have trouble finding the parts, so to speak, but you want to get a metal coffee can, and you want to go out and find the evil plastic straws that we're not supposed to use. You know, maybe you can salvage them from somewhere, some enterprise that's changing over. Maybe you'll take their old plastic ones. Because all you would do, you cut one end off the coffee can, which you got to do to get to the coffee, and then hang it sideways, facing south, southeast, but in a protected location where, you know, it's not going to rain directly on them or snow on them in the winter.
Okay.
And then you just, I mean, you can imagine this. You fill up the circular coffee can with as many straws pointing outward. Make sure the straws are long enough to extend at least a couple inches beyond the edge of the can, and they will come, and you will know that they have come when you start seeing plant debris inside the straws. That means the local mason bees, who would have been looking for a similar structure, are going to live with you, and, you know, next year, sure, put up another one. Some people used to at least take old cigar casings, the plastic, hard plastic that one would come in, and just line those up on like a ledge or something like that, and they would be used. Now, now that I think about it, I don't want to do that because of the nicotine, which is very deadly to bees. But the coffee can and the straws, I mean, that is a perfect way to draw them yourself, and you don't have to worry about bringing in a different species, different subspecies.
Great suggestion. I'll follow that practice. We'll give it a try.
All right. Well, The bees be with you. I'm sorry, folks.
Thank you again, Michael.
All right. You take care, man.
You too.
Bye-bye. As promised, it is time for the question of the week. What should you do when asters get too tall? Peter from the Pottawatomie Park Advisory Council in the Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago writes, "Greetings to Mike and the You Bet Your Garden team. We're working in one of our neighborhood parks, rehabilitating and enhancing the landscape and gardens. 3 years ago, we removed some overgrown yews, which shocked the neighbors as they didn't realize the building next to the yews actually had any windows." Mike interrupts. "I have to say that you're being very nonchalant in your report of that yew removal, especially considering the height you describe. I, quote, inherited two prostate yews when I bought our house back in the 80s, and it took me many years to get their roots out of the ground. Next to wisteria, they are the most tenacious plants I have ever had to tackle. Next time I have to face an impossible-to-remove plant, I'm calling Chicago. 2 years ago, we planted New England aster plugs from a mail-order nursery in their place. The problem is that they grew really well, 4 feet tall in their very first year. But in their second year, they reached 8 feet tall, and then they started to bend over just as they flowered in October. These wonderful asters are in a rich, loamy, well-draining soil in full sun. Now, I've heard that you can prune asters to keep them short and bushy. The question is, when should I do this? And is this a one-time pinching of the shoots as the plants grow? Or is it a continuous process throughout the growing season? Thanks for any advice you can offer on our asters." Well, thank you, Peter, for a very well-timed question. Whenever a plant blooms very late in the season, spring is the time to prepare it to put on its best show in the fall. Although a surprising number of sources encourage gardeners to prune their asters back to the ground after the first freeze of winter, that's bad advice for any plant, especially in Chicago, where cold winters and legendary winds combine to challenge the survival of many perennials. I've said it many times, but it's always good to repeat. Do not clean up your garden in the fall. Yes, that bad advice is very attractive to bored gardeners who want to spend more time outside before winter arrives, but it can be fatal to the plants they lovingly attack. Deadheading of old flowers is recommended, but again, many sources will urge you to remove those faded flowers right after the first hard freeze. But doing so denies wild birds the abundant natural seed in those faded flowers. And the plant in question is native, meaning that your birds and those seeds have coexisted for centuries. If the sight of old blooms doth offend thine eyes, you can pinch off the dead flowers a month or so later, but resist the urge to prune the plants themselves. Chicago winters can be nasty, and you want your perennials to have the best possible chance of survival, which means leaving their stems in place to capture as much snow as possible over top of their crowns. If you cut everything back to the ground at the end of the season, you lose those stems and expose the crowns of your plants to severe winter injury, especially if the weather is cold and windy without any snow cover. You always want as much upright plant material as possible in the garden to catch and collect snow and help insulate those crowns against temperature swings. The time to prune is in the spring, long after all possibility of a late frost is gone. Because they are late bloomers, there's no flower buds to worry about. So feel free to reduce the plants to half their size. This action alone should result in bushier plants come fall. But the best way to achieve great bushiness, as opposed to bending over, is to start pinching the plants back by literally using your thumb and forefinger to pinch off the ends of branches. You can also cut some branches back to improve the shape of the plant and to keep the height around that ideal 4 to 5 feet. The more pinching, the more compact the plant, and the less likely it is to flop over. This is like topiary, where constant pinching and light pruning of wayward parts throughout the season is necessary to maintain the desired shape. And pinching back is also the way to make hardy mums look the way they did when you bought them back in the fall, instead of the ungodly mess they turn into when left to their own resources. Stop pinching and pruning around mid-July and allow the flowers to appear. There should be lots more of them now, and they should be more closely packed together. And we have to congratulate you on your choice of plants. Asters are not only native, but they're in bloom when other flowers are scarce, and bees and butterflies are still looking for food. They are also host plants for many kinds of butterfly caterpillars. Note, aster clumps will become crowded over time, reducing their flowering and increasing the risk of them being lanky. Plan to dig them up and divide them in the spring in their fourth or fifth year. Replant some in the same spot and move the rest to other parts of the garden. Well, that sure was some helpful information about keeping New England asters nice and compact now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure at the Gardens Alive section of the Gurneys website. That's G-U-R-N-E-Y-S. Just visit that site and click on Garden Resources or type Gurneys plus You Bet Your Garden into your favorite search engine. Yikes, my producer is threatening to unpinch my asters if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 888-492-9444 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse of a question, teeming to our garden shore at mikemcgee@ptd, that's PTD as in Peter Thomas David, .net. Once again, that's mikemcgee@ptd.net. Please include your location. You'll find all of our updated contact information, plus audio of this show, audio and video of previous shows, and links to our internationally renowned podcast. It's all at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. Our radio show is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he received a fortune cookie with no message in it. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our chief content officer is Yoni Greenbaum. Our angel of the airways is Christine Dempsey. Our engineer is Cheerful Charlie Sarah. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Check out her fine work and keep track of our updated contact information at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. And send her pictures of your pretty plants for posting. Our peerless princess of profound production is Jasmine Griffin. Our irreplaceable audio editor is the lovely Jonas Bowen. Our croupier is Tim Fallon. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be looking at tiny starts and dreaming of tomatoes to come until I can see you again next week.